Okay, it's episode 2, somewhat late, of the Back to Front show. My name is Keir Whittaker, and once again, I'm joined by Mr. Kieran Masterton. Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
Not bad. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. A bit twitchy, apparently. Too many coffees?
I've had about 4 today. I'm a little bit on edge.
Is that 4 Colonna and Smalls, the finest coffee emporium in Bath?
Yes. Well, no, one home, the rest, Colonna and Smalls.
Aeropress, was it?
Yes.
Pretty strong stuff. So, I think firstly, apologies to the people who were expecting episode 2 on Saturday. We failed miserably and to record at New Adventures Conference up in Nottingham last week. All the best intentions, though.
Best intentions, but I think a bar got in our way.
A bar got in the way, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of bars. But I like to refer to this as it's a difficult second podcast. You know, we obviously peaked with the first
album.
One. Yeah, the Awkward album. So who knows what's going to happen in the next half hour, but we shall see. But so yeah, we were up at New Adventures Conf, NA Conf, last week in Nottingham.
We were.
And the delights of the Premier Inn, always good. Great breakfast.
Lovely.
Continental
£8. Can't go wrong.
Continental £5.25. And
you were being good.
I was, but you just weren't allowed the hot items.
No,
but anyway,
you allowed the beautifully baked or something, weren't you?
You weren't allowed
to stray into the buffet.
Yeah, not stray into the to the ordering with the chef. But anyway, enough of the breakfast. But it was good couple of days, and I had one particular highlight, which I think in terms of the talks was Wayne Hemingway, the founder of Red or Dead, which. Collie roped in sort of as a replacement for Dan Cederholm, who couldn't make it.
Really?
I think what was interesting for me about his talk was that it wasn't really web or design related. It was kind of the story of his business from a sort of teenager right through to sort of the work that he's doing now in architecture and town planning, so fashion, design, vintage clothes, all those kind of things. Hopefully the videos will be released at some point, but was that one of your highlights or what were the others?
Yeah, it was definitely, he was fantastic. And I think he'd obviously been asked to talk about risk, and he delivered beautifully on that, because it was sort of incredible lesson for us all, wasn't it? The sort of situation he found himself in, followed by the successes he had. So yeah, he was definitely high up on my list. And Seb was brilliant. So
yeah, his
live coding.
His live coding with the Commodore 64. Did you have one of those? What was your first computer?
I was an Atari XE man.
XE, not XT.
XE. I was tape drive all the way. Bit basic. Lovely.
Yeah, a bit of basic. Yeah. Yeah, I think, what do we have? A BBC Micro, something like that.
Oh, gosh.
It had a disk drive.
You're posh.
Well, probably. Yeah,
I think so.
I've gone down since then, don't worry. But NAConf was great. It's the last one. There's promise that it might return in some guise at some form in the future, but we'll have to wait and see. But there are, thankfully, plenty of other conferences to keep us busy.
Certainly are.
But so we had actually some correspondence after the first show.
Really?
Really, it's true. Someone emailed in, a guy called Matt Pass, or Matt Pass, depending on which part of the country you're from, who's the developer of IceCoder, which is an online coding environment. Have you had a chance to check that out?
I have. I haven't had a chance to actually use it. I've used the demo.
Use the demo. It's So what we thought to do today was talk a little bit about, I've actually called it What's in Your Toolbox.
Right.
Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
So what's in your toolbox, Kieran? But no, don't answer that. But so I thought we'd have a little bit of chat about some of the new tools and things that are out there that can help your day-to-day coding, particularly sort of local development and that kind of stuff. And neither of us are particular users of online coding environments. There's a few of those out there now, and I think it's a great demonstration of what's possible in the browser. But both of us more, I think, inclined to use local sort of development tools. And have you finally switched to Sublime Text 2, or are you still a TextMate man?
I'm a hybrid.
A hybrid?
I've got personal projects in Sublime and client work in TextMate.
Now, how did you arrive at this?
This is me transitioning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how are you finding that?
Well, you know that I get very stuck in my ways. And,
it has been said, not by me solely.
Just by clients, probably. Yeah. I'm very much married to TextMate for a long time. But I do I am seeing the benefits of Sublime, and I've been playing with that quite a lot, but mainly for my own stuff. Not because I need something specific in text mate, just because, you know, it's about comfortable, how comfortable I am, and, you know, how quickly I can code in and stuff.
Yeah, like it's muscle memory as well, as I believe the people call it. So, you know, used to the keystrokes and that kind of thing. So what made you want to try out Sublime Text 2? It's a very powerful text editor with
peer pressure. Yeah.
Sorry.
I felt out of the loop.
Yeah. So people were like looking down their nose in the coffee shop when they realized.
Yeah, people were sort of looking over at me and going, oh, he's still running TextMate.
TextMate. So what happened to TextMate 2?
What about it?
Is it out? I mean, is it supported? What happened there?
I don't know, to be honest.
I think I tried an alpha release and really didn't notice too much difference apart from the dock icon. But then everyone sort of saying all the cool kids were using Sublime. But it is very good, and there's a great free course on NetTuts. It's a premium course, but it's free. Which I think's the videos are done by Jeffrey Way over at NetTuts, and it takes you through start to finish. All of the keystrokes and some of the key plugins. So you can have like plugins for like GitHub and things like that. So you can just, short commands that you can commit files and that kind of stuff. But one we were both impressed by, and I'd be interested to hear your take on it, is Emmet.
Yeah, I've really been using Sublime just to get my head around Emmet, really, and start using it in Anger. And it's really, really, really nice. Formerly known as Zen coding,
so you might have noticed that. What does it actually do?
A way to speed up your workflow.
Yeah, so I had a wee play with it, and so you can basically do text based commands. So I'm trying to think off the top of my head, something like, you can create a UL list with so many LIs with hrefs in it and that kind of thing. And
it's CSS syntax, basically, isn't it?
And then when you hit a return, it kind of whacks in all that HTML into your editor, right?
That's right, yeah. So it's really just, you can write stuff in short form, and then, you know, it'll drop that block of code straight in.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've used in the past things like Text Expander for snippets of code that I often reuse, and I use Text Expander for things like terminal shortcuts and things like that, where it's like, you know, change directory into this thing and log into this server and that kind of thing. But I think this takes it to a different degree. I really like it. I haven't committed it enough to memory yet in order to really take advantage of it, though. I think I need to sit down for sort of half a day. I think one of the problems I've had with Sublime Text is that once you start installing a bunch of the plugins, the keystrokes kind of get overwritten. And so what you think used to be a certain pattern is suddenly hijacked by one of the other plugins. So I can tend to get a bit lost and a bit frustrated that I've installed something like Emmet and a previous keystroke for a different plugin now no longer works. But thankfully you can edit all those. There's a JSON configuration file that you can go in and edit the keystrokes. But I think once you get above a certain number of plugins, it gets a little bit difficult to remember.
It has to happen with anything that has sort of packages installed into it, doesn't it? That you get this thing where it starts overwriting defaults and things unless the application is very strict and locks that down. It tends to be the case that, you know, the more packages you've got installed, the more complicated your keystrokes have to become to overcome that.
Exactly. One of the features that our friend John particularly liked about Sublime was the split screen view. Have you tried that out? So where you
I know John was very into that. Yeah.
So you'd have sort of HTML on one side and CSS on the other and that kind of stuff. They've also got that funky little, how would you sort of like an aerial view of your code? Do you have that turned on?
Yes, like the full screen view of your code that you can quickly jump around in the file. Yeah.
Makes you feel like you've done an awful lot of work.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because more code is better code, right?
What's that?
More code is better code.
Exactly.
The more you write, the better you are. Yeah, at least for me. Why write something in 3 lines that can be written in 30? It's a motto I've lived by for a long time. You can charge more.
CSS.
Well, it does. Exactly. But have you always used text editors? Have you ever used IDEs?
No, I've always used text editors. I was always a Vi man back in the day, in the days of Perl and everything.
Is it Vi, not Vi? Is it Vi? Is that how you say it?
Vi.
Vi. Yeah. I know. I think it's Ryan Singer from 37 Signals is often singing the praises of Vi.
Mm-hmm.
It
tends to get very fast when you use Vi, just, you know, every day.
So, what's the benefits of using something like that over Sublime? Or
I mean, are there none? Personally, I don't really see it. You know, I mean, I've always, you know, it doesn't really bother me as long as I know the package. You know, I'm not worried. I don't really see the benefits of using it, though I'm sure, you know, I'm sure other people could tell you that. I know that you can use, you know, sort of regular expressions to pattern match the stuff within your files and things like that. And that, that was always helpful, but I don't, you know, I'm not a, extremely fluent in regex type guy, so it's not a massive help for me.
If you're dealing, say, with some, with the, you know, you're setting up a server or you're editing configuration files on a server, what's your sort of command line interface editor of choice?
Vim. Every time now.
Ah, is that a, does that derive from Vi?
Yeah.
What's the M for then?
I don't know.
Okay, and what's what makes that a good sort of environment to sort of edit in?
Sorry?
What makes that a good environment to edit in terms of like when you're changing configuration files and things like that?
This is really nice. It's got syntax highlighting and that kind of thing. And
okay.
It just allows you to, you know, just the same way Vi does or did, you know, it just allows you to edit on the command line very quickly.
Ah, okay.
What do you use?
Nano.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
For what reason?
Adam Cook showed it me once and I didn't know that anything else existed really.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe if you want to show me Vim, you know, maybe I'll become Vim. You know, I'm stuck in my ways like you. It does the job. I actually realized it had search built in the other day.
Well, Nano.
You can search for a string and it kind of, you know, it's pretty impressive.
Nice.
Yeah, we'll leave that one. I actually started off using what became Dreamweaver. I know they're not utter those words these days, but it was actually called Macromedia Ultra Dev. And, it was one of the first ones that I tried that had, I guess, built-in HTML rendering. It used some kind of HTML engine that existed in no other browser at the time, which was no good thing. But you could literally switch between the sort of code and sort of, you know, real what you would theoretically see in a browser. But this was the time when the rival editor was something called HTML Dog, I think, or HTML Coffee or something. I can't remember. It was the best of a baddish bunch. But I used that for a long time, but switched to text editors probably, I don't know, eight or 9 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, I remember, I used to use Vi originally, but then I know that the company I used to work for insisted upon Dreamweaver. And so I was really used to use that in the code view only. And then switched, I think, to Text Wrangler.
Text Wrangler. I think they, I often see them advertising on the deck, Text Wrangler 2.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it says something like, you know, 58 new features, or in Text Wrangler 2, something $50.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's an interesting one. I know a lot of people like Coda is another environment that people use.
Yeah.
And I bought it.
You did? Okay.
I did. But I just couldn't get into it. Again, I don't know if I'm stuck in my ways or whether it was just...
Because Coda 2's out, isn't it?
Sorry, that's what I mean. Coda 2, yeah.
Happening.
Coda 2. And... I just couldn't, you know, I tried and some beautiful stuff in there and I love what the Panic guys do, but I think I went back to the comfort of Sublime and just cracked on that way. What do you feel about having things like FTP or, you know, command line interface built into your coding environment? Have you ever been comfortable with that? Do you think there's a place for that?
No, I mean, I've never really been a fan of that, to be honest with you. I've always wanted to keep those things separate. You know, I'm not a big fan of FTP, as you know.
Yeah, let's not go down that route.
So I don't typically find myself there. To be honest with you, I find myself switching between, you know, a text editor and the, you know, terminal.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. So I just switch back and forth.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. The reason we were sort of mentioning FTP, there's a few tools around we've noticed, I think you were talking about one today, where it allows you to, if you give your FTP credentials to the service, you can then, I mean, what it allows you to edit your site and it pushes it back. I think this one in particular was called Selector App.
Yeah, that's right. So I think the idea is you give it your FTP credentials, it then interprets the HTML that it finds and allows you to, you know, edit that HTML, and then it'll push it back to your server for you.
Interesting. Do you think there's a place for that for small client work, or do you think it's just sort of mixing a metaphor, for want of a better word?
My personal opinion is that FTP in general is dangerous, just from a security point of view. Never recommend for anyone to have it running on their server. But I think, you see, this is a difficult thing because I think everything's about context, and, you know, the clients that I work with would not be happy with something like that, but I can totally see a place for that kind of thing. Yeah. I just wish it used SSH and Git or something.
Yeah, I suppose there is a barrier to to something like SSH and Git, though, isn't there, to for a lot of people? Yeah. And whereas it's more second nature to you, I've got a lot of, you know, very talented, you know, we know a lot of talented people who find those concepts quite difficult to get into. But it does feel that Git has kind of transcended that level of understanding. But I put that down to say, you know, tools like GitHub, things like that have made it more accessible. Would you agree with that?
I think the GitHub, you know, GitHub almost teaches you to use it as you use it. And I think that's one of their great successes.
Mm, yeah. I mean, it does pretty much handles repositories, and that's what it, you know, that's mm-hmm. all it does. They also do some funky merchandise.
Do they?
Yeah.
I've heard that. I heard they do coasters.
The coasters, yeah. Do you actually use those?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're on my desk.
Oh, that's good. Birthday present from last year. They're quite smart, though. Leather GitHub coasters.
What's that?
The leather GitHub coasters.
Yeah,
can't actually say that. Anyways, but yeah. So SaaS. You're getting into SaaS.
Gradually. Let's not push it. No, no. I am using SaaS. Yeah, I used SaaS on OpenIndie when I first when we rebuilt that. Still isn't second nature, but as you know, front end isn't always my most comfortable world.
You really do aspire to be a good front ender, don't you?
Yes, I do. I do, yeah.
we all want to be as good as Graham, don't we, really? Actually, going back to NA Comp, Graham, anyone who knows Graham Smith, what is he on Twitter?
Garblaxian.
Yeah, him. Amazing beard. Amazing beard. Probably the best beard in web.
Code Warrior.
Yep. He, his bait goods were exceptional this year.
They were. And such variety.
Yeah, he pitched up at the pub on the day before. Out comes the kind of Tupperware case. There's probably five varieties, brownies. What I thought were macaroons.
The drizzle cake was amazing.
Yeah, the macaroons, he said more of a biscuit, but good density to it. Anyway, we digress. Graham, thank you. So SaaS is something I've been using a lot more over the last couple of years, mainly thanks to Mr. Annandale, Greg_A on Twitter.
Saw him today.
And it was one of those things that I remember reading about 2 or 3 years ago, maybe longer now, when it came out, and I just couldn't quite understand the use case, which looking back is ridiculous. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there that makes it your coding and your speed to getting stuff out a lot quicker. And Greg has a little library of mix-ins, basically shortcuts to you know, big bulky bits of CSS and that kind of stuff. And I used that on a couple of projects and then got more into Compass and those kind of things. And around a year, 18 months ago, there were a whole bunch of tools that allowed you to work with SaaS in a more friendly way. Originally, you would install it. I think it was a Ruby gem, and you'd have to go into Terminal and set things running and that kind of stuff, which was, you know, it's relatively easy. The instructions on the site are great, but nevertheless, there's a little bit of a barrier there. But there's a whole bunch of tools now that allow you to work with SaaS or less, but you don't hear so much about less anymore, which is a sort of equivocal preprocessor. I've been using Mixture a lot, which we spoke about last week. Yes. I know that tools like Hammer for Mac allow you to deal with SaaS as well. Mm-hmm. Do you have a preference, or what do you use?
A CodeKit all the time, yeah.
Oh, CodeKit, of course, yeah. CodeKit's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it kind of, I always like to think of that as an add-on to your environment. It doesn't try and take over. It's a nice little plugin. So
that's what I like about it, really. As I said, you know, I spend my time switching back and forth between Terminal and the text editor. I don't really want something that takes over my environment.
Yeah, so for anyone who's maybe not tried CodeKit for Mac, it's I think it's not free. There's a trial, but it's an interesting pricing model where I think it gives you three options. You can either pay a little, something in the middle, and then a bit more. I think the bit more is about $40, so it's not huge, but it's something I've been using for about a year now, and it plugs into your workflow quite happily. It watches a folder, and it will scan it, and, you know, it will recognize things like JavaScript files. It will recognize SAS files or LESS files and all these kind of things. And you can then ask it to perform various functions when you save those files. For example, a SAS file, you can specify the file that it wants to sort of compile down to. You can specify whether it wants that to be condensed all and minified and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The JavaScript stuff is really nice as well, because it allows you to have a sort of master JavaScript file that you can then tell it to include other JavaScript files in with the @CodeKit prepend directive. Mm-hmm. So it allows you to create one big file of JavaScript and concatenate it and minify it and all those kind of things, but still keep your different libraries separate, so you don't, you know, get confused and that kind of stuff.
That's very nice, isn't it?
But yeah, I mainly use that for the SAS and the live reload stuff, which is great. The only thing is with SAS, once you start using something like Compass, which is a, I don't know how you describe Compass. It's like a whole bunch of mix-ins that kind of allow you to shortcut things like background, you know, imagery and all that kind of stuff, or just simple fixes for things like inline block. One of the quick wins is definitely include the different files from Compass that you need, because if you do the global at include Compass, the compilation takes longer and longer the bigger your file gets. So that's definitely one tip.
And that's interesting, because that can that explain people saying that CodeKit just takes, it just starts to get, you know, more and more and more slow every time they use it.
It might be, yes. I think particularly with Compass, native SAS with a couple of mixing files is really quick anyway. But I think once you use Compass or one of those libraries, there are a couple of others out there. I forget. I think there's one called Bourbon, something like that. And there's a whole bunch of grid ones as well that you can install. If you don't sort of specify which files that you want from Compass, it's obviously going to run through the lot, and it just takes a lot longer to compile.
I see, yeah.
There's some interesting issues with that, though. So particularly with, say, concatenation and minifying, when you sort of speak to more hardcore developers, they all argue that that should be done on the server at deployment, whereas tools like CodeKit for Mac and that, they do it at source. And so if you're working in a team, it can get a little bit interesting. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I do see this very much as sort of an individual developer type tool.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not sure how well it works in a team. I think that when you get into that situation, it should be done on the server. And I think that, you know, especially if you're working on a larger product, for example, you know, a Rails app or something, then it becomes, you know, sensible to use that pipeline rather than to use something, you know, native to your machine.
As is the Rails asset pipeline.
That's it. Feature,
yeah.
So but basically, that's the same thing.
Right.
It's
okay.
Just that, you know, it's done centrally on the server.
Okay, interesting. And talking of servers, locally, are you a MAMP man or your local Apache man?
A MAMP man. I do have MAMP installed, though. I use it less and less, just chiefly because I don't really like it.
You got to qualify that. You can't just say, I don't really like it.
For, you know, WordPress type stuff and PAL for Rails stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
How are you?
I'm a MAMP pro man, really.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Mainly just because it's simple. I mean, I now possess the small amount of knowledge to edit a config file to allow me to run the local Apache. But I kind of like the way that it's just sandboxed into its own environment. It gives you MySQL, those kind of things. So do you run databases locally as well? Are they?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah, you're proper, aren't you?
Well, yeah. Depends how you look at it.
You're the sort of guy who has like 8-point in the terminal, whereas I'm sort of 14, nicely spaced in flashing green. Yeah, I know your sort. Yeah, so I think MAMP Pro was it. What does it stand for?
Don't know. To be honest with you, I
MySQL Apache.
I used it for a little bit, and then I didn't like it, so I, you know, went back to what I was doing.
I've got
as
it.
As we said before, stuck in my ways.
Macintosh, Apache, MySQL, PHP.
There you go,
MAMP. But yeah, so, but PHP, actually, we were talking about this the other day. I think it's in the latest release. Is it 5.3.6 or something along those lines? Has a local server built in.
Yeah, I think it's 5.4 and up.
5.4 and up. Which is quite interesting. I wonder why they've never sort of offered that before. Do you think this is, they're just trying to get more in line with some of the other sort of frameworks, and Ruby on Rails obviously ships with its own web server, things like Django ships with its own server, that kind of stuff. And what do you think their motivation for that is?
I mean, I think my personal opinion is that I think that things like Python and Ruby have forced PHP to sort of up their game a little bit.
Right, okay.
I think PHP was sort of a little bit complacent, and I'm sure there'll be PHP devs out there saying, what are you talking about? But I think that, you know, PHP has the disadvantage that it's sort of been around longer. It's a bit messier. You know, I don't know how many articles I see a week about PHP being broken, but they're obviously, you know, working to rectify that. And I think this is one of those things that they've done. They've also got a interactive shell now.
Okay, explain what that means.
So it's like, do you know what IRB is for Ruby?
IRB.
It's a Ruby shell, basically. So
yeah.
So you can throw out code into an interactive shell and get back what, you know, what that will give you, if you see what I mean. So,
what is a shell?
What is a shell? You know, 2 + 2, it'll say 4.
Oh, okay. Right.
So effectively it's really good for testing what you're doing and to sort of trying out things and working out, you know, what happens when you do this and that kind of thing. And I think it's PHP-A on the command line will give you the interactive shell.
That's interesting, because do you think that will help with sort of debugging? Is it one of those kind of
useful for that? Yeah, it's really useful for saying, and the same thing goes for Ruby with IRB. It's the same thing for you know, if you're learning a language, or if you're not learning a language, if you just want to work out what's going on in your code, you can drop into that and start doing, you know, just putting a line at a time and seeing what the output is.
Yeah, because debugging is one of those interesting things with PHP. Certainly in MAMP, it gives you you know, a shortcut link to the log file, which is, you know, often super helpful. Depending on, I mean, things like the infamous white screen of death with WordPress, you're presented with a white screen, you've no idea what's going on, and it could be that your error settings are so you know, locked down that you won't know unless you look at the error log. So
for that kind of thing, yeah.
Say again, sorry?
And the interactive shell is really useful for that kind of thing, just to work out what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. And learning a few things around sort of error reporting and things like that, and will help you a lot, particularly with WordPress. It doesn't really give you much feedback necessarily. No,
and you know, you really have to, you know, be logging, well, at least locally, you have to be logging everything really to work out what WordPress is doing, because that it suppresses errors.
Yeah. Which is
not, I mean, I don't think that's particularly useful. I think that should be handled, you know, elsewhere. I don't think it should be done in your code.
There's a flag in wp-config, isn't there, for error or debug or something. And if you
and debug on, yeah.
Yeah. Which normally results in an awful lot of notices appearing, but it's no bad thing.
Yes.
But you're a Rails guy as well. And we've got a couple of sort of Rails tools to discuss down here as well. So so in terms of servers developing with Rails, it ships with Webrick still, or is Webrick, there something more
built in,
more sexy Rails, these days?
Rails S, that's what runs. And to be honest with you, you know, if anybody says to me what shall I use, I just say, you know, just go with it out of the box, learn using that. If you're not running multiple applications on your machine, you don't need to stray into the world of Power. I'm sure other Ruby developers would say, you know, there's reasons to use it, but you know, that's what I feel. And once I got multiple applications that I was working with, you know, client work plus my own stuff, I switched to POW.
So what's POW?
So POW is basically, I mean, I think, well, I can't remember what they call it. It's a Rails and Rack server. It's sort of zero config. It's the whole, you know, methodology around it, I guess. You effectively, when you set it up, you clone your project. You do a symlink from your home.pow folder to that project, and the name of that folder becomes, or the name of the symlink, sorry, becomes the name of your POW project.
Okay.
Does that make sense? The URL of your POW project.
Right. So it's a tool that helps you set up multiple local Rails sites effectively. Is that how you describe it? Or
that, and I normally use that in conjunction with Anvil.
Oh, right. This is it's from our friends down the road here in Bath.
Yeah.
So what does Anvil do? Is that it's Anvil for Mac, isn't it? It sits in the sort of, it's not the toolbar. What's the thing at the top of the screen on a Mac? Do they call it the toolbar?
Yeah.
Toolbar. It sits in the toolbar and allows you to switch. Yeah, allows you to switch between your POW projects. Is that right?
It's just really, really simple, but really clever. And, you know, I think I've said to Elliot before, like, I would pay for it. it's free, but I would have paid for it.
Yeah, it's interesting because they're the guys behind Hammer for Mac, which is obviously a paid for product that they're working
on. That's right, yeah.
What's the sort of
Talking about Ruby stuff, I tend to use that in conjunction with RVM as well.
This is interesting.
So RVM is Ruby version manager.
Yeah.
And it basically allows you to have multiple Ruby installs on your local machine or on a server, actually, for that matter.
So my understanding of this is that, let's say you're a Rails dev and you're working on a legacy project. You're allowed to effectively compartmentalize an older version of Rails with maybe an older version of Ruby in its own little area. And then have another one for maybe the bleeding edge version of Rails with the bleeding edge version of Ruby, and the two don't conflict with each other. Is that correct?
Sort of. Okay. So say I want to have Ruby 1.8.7.
As you do.
So?
As you do.
And say, for whatever reason, maybe a legacy app, whatever. And I want to also have Ruby 1.9.2. And I might have multiple projects written in 1.9.2.
Right.
And so what I want to do is I want to have that version of Ruby, but I also want to have multiple gem sets, and that's what really makes RVM really powerful, I think.
That
you can say, I'm going to have this list of gems for this project, I have that list of gems, because you might want to say, you know, there's a Vimeo gem. Okay, so say you might want to have two different versions of the Vimeo gem on different projects, and it just helps you, you know, do that.
So for the uninitiated, what is a Ruby gem?
So Ruby gem is, I guess, if you're familiar, I'm trying to think of an analogy to draw. It's a library, effectively.
Okay, so it's a bunch of code, right?
It's a bunch of code that you can include in your Rails application or, yeah, you know, any Ruby application. So, I mean, you could look at it if you're WordPress savvy, you could look at it as a plugin.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I would probably describe it as... it's not code you necessarily include in your own project, but you reference it, and it also gives you the opportunity when the developer of the project has updated the gem or, you know, updated the functionality, you can literally just go in and update the gem, and you don't really have too much to worry about. It's also really useful, isn't it, when you're deploying an application with Ruby, that you have this kind of gem file, and things like Heroku will just go off and grab those gems and install them in your instance and things like that. So I think it's
management is, yeah, the gem file stuff, you know, yeah, bundle and the gem file is really designed to ensure that you've got the right dependencies installed.
Yeah, so it's interesting sort of to wrap up this little bit on sort of tools and things that sort of help us in our everyday coding. Recently I've been exposed, that sounds terrible, I was working on the site for this for the podcast, and I did it in something called Slim Framework, which is if anyone's ever used Sinatra for Ruby, it's very, very similar. It's a sort of very, very simple framework that allows you to map sort of functions to URLs effectively. So, you know, if this is the URL, then execute this function, include that template, and so on and so forth. And
the action controller sort of model, but for routes, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Very simple, but allows you to get up and running very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And there's a Skeleton sort of app. I think it's actually called Skeleton. That includes the Twig template language for PHP, which is a really nice sort of templating language. It's available on GitHub by the guy who does Slim, but he uses something called Composer for PHP, which I guess is, it's like a package manager for PHP, which is new to me. And I think, again,
so I've seen that about, but again, you know, it's been a while since I've used PHP, really for building applications. So, but I have, you know, I've discussed that with other devs while talking about stuff they're doing.
Yeah, it works really well. You install it on the command line and you can go in and update and remove sort of, I forget the term they use for the actual sort of packages, but, it threw me a bit when I deployed the site because I was like, you know, there's no templating. What's going on here? And obviously I hadn't gone into the server and, run the command to install all the packages through Composer. And once I did that, it was great. Everything just happened there. I think it's a nice way for PHP, which traditionally I always felt lagged behind in some of these tools and techniques, but that might be my lack of knowledge, to come up to speed and have these ability for people to release stuff and have it managed in a sort of developed environment as well. So you can literally go in and say, okay, I'm updating that package. The twig's been updated. I don't have to kind of check it all out, put it into my code base and so on and so forth. So it feels like it's kind of maturing in that respect, but for all I know, it could have been out for sort of 3 or 4 years, but only recently have I started sort of seeing more reference to it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I might be wrong here, but, you know, I feel like the PHP world is slightly more fractured than the Ruby world. It feels like, you know, there is the way to do things in Ruby, and this, whether that's, you know, just perceived or real, I don't know, but because I think that, you know, obviously there's far greater adoption of PHP, you know, worldwide. I think there's lots of different ways of doing similar things, and people don't necessarily find out about things because, you know, we were saying that, you know, we're not really sure how long Composer's been around. But, you know, it could have been around for ages and we just didn't know about it. Whereas in the Ruby one, I think that tends to happen less. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I think it's it's a fashion thing, I think, as well. You know, Ruby sort of 5-6 years ago was everywhere. It was new. 37 Signals were doing interesting stuff with it. And, you know, it seemed to came at a time when making sort of blogs was hard work. Everyone was doing it themselves. And then suddenly you had this kind of scaffolding and all that kind of stuff. And I think it, I think coding environments and languages are what's the word? Sort of dictated by fashion and trend to a certain degree as well. I often feel like I'm left behind because I'm not, you know, my site's not got any kind of CoffeeScript or, you know, Node in it, but it kind of does the job. So get there in the end. any other things that you use regularly in terms of tools and local environment stuff?
I think.
I know for me on the sort of front end stuff, I use Image Optim for image optimization quite a lot, which kind of really compresses down file size for your projects of images and PNGs and that kind of stuff. But CoKit,
if you want to use the PHP shell, that there's actually, you know, the PHP interactive shell, there's actually, and it's a sort of a more fully featured version. It doesn't ship with it, but apparently there's some limitations to the dash A approach, and you can use a thing that is actually called PHP shell.
Oh, okay.
We can link to it in the show notes or whatever, but it gives you a lot more functionality.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, I think we'll definitely talk on another show about sort of deployment strategies. I know that's something that we both, particularly in relation to WordPress, have a bunch of ideas on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that's pretty much it, really. We've covered quite a lot there, and we'll link up all the different tools and technologies in the show notes. Anything shiny to talk about this week? Any new kit that's caught your eye?
No, anything shiny on my list of things to talk about, unfortunately.
Says the man who's just ordered a new Mac.
Oh, well, that is quite shiny, yeah. I've gone 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro.
Yeah, you're just bragging now about your 15-inch MacBook Retina Pro. But yeah, I'm interested to see that, actually, because you've moved from the Air, so you're going to be packing more weight. You've gone for the bigger screen. What made you change?
Well, you know, I had this sort of fantasy that I would actually be, you know, I'd use my big screen, I'd plug into that, or I'd use the iMac or whatever. It never actually really happens. You know, I'm either in a coffee shop or I'm, you know, in someone else's office or I'm wherever, and or sitting on the sofa for that matter. And I never actually end up plugging into a big screen. I think, you know, that's probably bad, especially for my eyes and that kind of stuff. But, you know, the reality is that I'm 99.9% of the time on the laptop. And I just thought the extra screen real estate might be a good thing.
Yeah, so you can go up from 8-point in terminal to maybe 9, maybe 10.
Yeah, push it, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to change too many habits, though.
No.
No, it's not a good thing.
But yeah, no, I went to the Apple store and I basically held the Mac, the Air, and I held the MacBook Pro, and I thought, actually, with, you know, the solid state and the Retina form factor, it was pretty, I mean, you know, I'm not going to deny that the MacBook Pro is heavier, but it was pretty marginal.
And interesting.
It certainly wouldn't concern me taking it, you know, on a flight or, you know, to a conference or putting it in my bag and, you know, walking to a coffee shop or anything.
You'll never fit it on one of those.
Would, you know, really make a massive difference. And for the power it, you know, offers and for the screen size and everything, I thought, you know, I'll switch to it.
You totally geeked out, didn't you? You just got trigger happy with the Apple sort of product creator and.
I did, yeah. I just waited for the maximum on everything.
Yeah, maxed out Mac. Hey, well, I look forward to salivating once you get it and getting Mac envy. But it'll be interesting to see, actually, just in terms of the size and, you know, how you work out with that. Because I have the 13-inch Air, mm-hmm. and the big screen, which I use quite a lot. But Elliot, he swears by his dual iMac and 11-inch Air. The perfect size, apparently, the 11-inch.
Really?
Apparently so. And also backed up by a number of people at last year's Build conference. I think we had a far too long conversation about the merits of the 11-inch versus 13. But anyway.
Ryan Taylor is rocking an 11-inch at the moment.
Does he rock an 11-inch? Because Ryan doesn't actually listen. He told us this much last week, so we could probably talk about him. But so he likes a good breakfast and he rocks an 11-inch.
He does, yeah. That's Ryan in a nutshell.
That is probably a good point to stop.
Yeah.
And are we going to try and get back on track? Are we going to do another one this week?
Are we? I don't know.
I don't know.
You tell me.
And I have to speak to the producer and see what they say. See if the budget extends. But we will be back. We will be back, hopefully back on track. The idea is to record in the week and then publish on a Saturday. But I cannot believe by episode two we managed to not do that. But hopefully we'll get back on track.
To say that we were going to record it at an ACOL.
Yeah, we did. We said that as well. And we took the Yetis. The Yetis travelled.
They did, yeah. But they in didn't style. Get used, unfortunately.
And then they sat on the side of my hotel room table. Never to see the light of day. But anyway, it was a good time. It was a good time.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, we've reached 40 minutes and we will be back in hopefully not too long a time. Let's not commit to it. But thank you for listening and we shall speak to you soon. Cheers.